From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Melissa Block. This week, an improbable partnership called on Congress. On one side, animal rights advocates, and on the same side, big egg producers. They're advocating together for a law that's supposed to improve the lives of egg-laying chickens. As NPR's Dan Charles reports, if passed, it would be the first federal law that takes into account the emotional lives of farm animals.
Ask two different people and you can get two completely different opinions about what makes a chicken feel comfortable.
You hear that sound? That's happy chickens.
John Bedell manages egg production for J.S. West, a family-run farming operation in Modesto, California.
When they're just sort of calmly clucking away, that's what happy chickens sound like.
We're standing in a long, windowless, dimly lit building. It's home to a whole city of chickens, 150,000 of them, in endless rows of wire cages, eight birds to a cage. On average, each hen has a little less space than a single sheet of paper. So are they really happy? Ask Paul Shapiro from the Humane Society of the United States, and he says, impossible.
These are living, feeling, sentient animals. And at a bare minimum, certainly they deserve not to be tortured for their entire lives, not to be immobilized to the point where they can't even extend their limbs.
Advocates of animal welfare have been angry about chicken cages for a long time, but until recently they couldn't do much about it. The system gives us cheap eggs. In fact, 90% of all the country's eggs come from chickens in cages. But in the last few years, activists here and around the world have started to win some victories. They succeeded first in Europe. By law, Euro chickens now have more room in cages, and many aren't in cages at all. They're running around loose in barns. Then, 3 years ago, voters in California overwhelmingly approved something called Proposition 2. Paul Shapiro from the Humane Society helped write it.
What Prop 2 says is that laying hens must be able to stand up, lie down, turn around, and fully extend their limbs. That's it.
They have to be able to do that by 2015. It sounds simple, but egg producers say they still have no idea what it requires. Does it mean chickens have to be cage-free? Does it just mean bigger cages? How big? On top of that, similar voter initiatives passed in other states. Gene Gregory, who's president of United Egg Producers, the egg industry's biggest trade association, says it looked like the industry would have to satisfy dozens of different and confusing state requirements.
It was going to be a nightmare trying to produce eggs and have a free flow of eggs across state lines. And so we reached out to the Humane Society and said, let's have a conversation about this.
And indeed, we were able to hammer out agreement to jointly lobby the Congress for new federal rules on the treatment of egg-laying hens.
The proposed law was introduced in Congress this week. It would require all egg producers in every state to move all of their animals out of traditional cages within 15 years. At a minimum, the chickens would have to be in so-called enriched cages, a style developed in Europe. These cages are a compromise between efficient, large-scale production and letting chickens do some things they really seem to like. At the J.S. West farm, one chicken house already has these cages. The chickens in this building have almost twice as much space as the ones I saw next door. Jill Benson, one of the company's owners, points out other things. There are metal bars for the birds to perch on. Also, some enclosed spaces called nest boxes, which seem really popular.
The birds, in fact, line up to go into the nest box. They like to go out of the bright light and go into a nest box to lay their eggs.
Jill Benson says she wants this law to pass. Building new chicken houses will cost her company millions of dollars, but she says she can live with that. It probably works out to about an extra penny per egg. So if the United Egg Producers, representing 95% of all U.S. egg production, wants this law, and some of the industry's fiercest enemies also want this law, who could be against it? Well, as it happens, some influential farm organizations. Beef producers, hog farmers, dairy farmers, and the American Farm Bureau have all lined up against it. Bill Donald, a rancher in Melville, Montana, and president of the National Cattlemen's Beef Association, says it would be a terrible precedent. Who knows what regulations might come next?
It isn't a very large leap to go from egg production to chicken production to beef production.
It's a political situation that would have been unthinkable just a year ago. Egg farmers, arm in arm with the Humane Society of the United States, doing battle with ranchers and dairymen. Dan Charles, NPR News.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Melissa Block. Each month, we invite our listeners sitting in the backseat of their parents' car or at the kitchen table to join our Backseat Book Club. This month's pick is The Watsons Go to Birmingham, 1963. NPR's Michelle Norris asked the author, Christopher Paul Curtis, to set up the story for us.
It's a family from Flint, Michigan, who has a 13-year-old semi-juvenile delinquent son named Byron, who is becoming increasingly bad. And so the parents decide to send him to Grandma Sands in Birmingham, Alabama, who has a reputation for being very tough.
The Watsons are an African-American family. Byron's younger brother, Kenny, is the comical narrator of the story. The all-important family road trip is central to this tale, and the family's venture to Birmingham is rich in vivid detail, from the songs the kids enjoy in the car.
Take out the papers and the trash, or you don't get no spending cash,
to their parents' mushy ballads.
Do I want to be with you?
The year is 1963, the destination Birmingham, on the eve of violence in the city that would shake a nation's conscience. But the story is anchored by love and humor. And as usual, our Backseat Book Club members had lots of comments and questions for the author.
Hi, my name is Daphne Coonan. I live in Lancaster, PA. Did you base any of the stories on your life, like the Nazi flamethrower of death? Thank you. I really enjoyed your book. Bye.
Well, it's interesting you ask that. Nazi parachutes, that's chapter 5. I know it well, and it's the most autobiographical thing that happened in the book. And it's where Byron lights toilet paper parachutes over the toilet and flushes them away. It was based on me. I just threw matches in the toilet. I liked the sound they made when they hit the water. And I was lighting and flushing, and my mother came in, and much as it happened in the story, threatened to burn me if I did it again. I said, I'll never do it again, Mama. And I smartened up. Next time I did it, I locked the bathroom door. She came in. She grabbed me by the collar. She kicked the door down. I can remember this very clearly. I was amazed that she had that power in her legs. And she came in. She grabbed me by the collar and lifted me with one hand. And as I was dangling there, I can remember thinking, I never would have done it if I knew she was this strong.
The title of that chapter is Nazi Parachutes Attack America and Get Shot Down Over the Flint River by Captain Byron Watson and His Flamethrower
flame
of Death.
Flamethrower of Death, yep.
This is the first Backseat Book Club where the main character in the book actually spends some time in the backseat of the family's car, actually quite a bit of time. And I want to talk a little bit about that journey and what it meant for you to place him in the back seat of a car and in a very particular car, the brown bomber, the father in the family really takes meticulous care of.
That's right. It 1948 Plymouth. It was based on a car that we had as children. The car was not painted brown, but all the paint had come off of the car, and it was in brown primer. So my father called it the Brown Bomber after Joe Louis. It was a wonderful time. You listened to the music. We didn't have an Ultraglide, of course. We just had the radio with two stations in Flint. So it was rather limited that way. But the car was a great place to be.
And the Ultraglide, that crazy contraption where people were actually playing record albums inside a moving vehicle.
Absolutely insane. It made the 8-track look like a good idea. It was the size of a suitcase. And it was really bad idea because every time you turned a corner or hit a bump, the needle would jump and scratch the record.
No, there wasn't much gliding. It was like the needle
bouncing
across.
It was more like the
record album.
The ultra scratch.
Yeah. Ow, it hurts my ears just to think about that. Did you decide to set much of this book inside a car, not just because of your father's love for his own Brown Bomber, but because of your relationship with cars? You spent a lot of time working on a factory line building cars.
I kind of fell into being an author. I really disliked the factory. I disliked it tremendously.
What were you doing? You were attaching doors to cars,
I was
right?
Hanging doors, they called it. It was a very physical job. The doors weighed anywhere from 50 to 80 pounds. each person would do 300 of them a day in a 10-hour shift. It was almost like a ballet, the way you had to have each step. Each step had to be done correctly, where you place your feet, you know, and it took a while to learn how to do it. But it was in there that my friend and I decided, the guy, Doug Tennant is his name, and we decided that instead of doing every other job, he'd do 30 in a row, and I'd do 30 in a row. And that gave us each a half hour out of every hour to sit down and do whatever we wanted to do. And then I found out that if I sat down and started to write, I forgot about being in the factory. And I think that that led to me being a writer.
Stolen moments. Eventually, Curtis left the factory for a year to follow his dream of writing. He put himself to work 5 hours a day at his local library, scrawling out the Watson story in longhand. The book went on to win the prestigious Newbery Honor. The book's humor delighted our readers, and many were also moved by the civil rights struggles and the church bombing that killed four little girls. Brothers Sebastian and Martin Parra from Nashville asked about that tumultuous period.
Mr. Curtis, did the bombing affect you as a kid?
And were you exposed to such radical behavior?
Sebastian and Martin, the bombing did affect me as a kid. I was 10 years old when it happened, and the reason it stuck in my mind, my parents were very, very strict. Now, I know you think your parents were strict. We used to go to bed at 6:30 every night, and my sister and I would some of the time sneak back up and sit behind the couch and watch television while my parents were watching it. And I can remember in 1963, September 15th, when the bombing took place, watching on television, and the reason it impacted me so much was because I'd never seen my parents cry before, and it was a very, very traumatic time when these four little girls were killed because they wanted to end segregation, so it did have an impact on my life.
Christopher Paul Curtis, he's the author of The Watsons Go to Birmingham, 1963. Thanks so much for being with us.
My pleasure. Thank you very much, Michelle. I appreciate it.
For February, NPR's Backseat Book Club is doing double duty, reading two books. Shooting Kabul by N.H. Senzai, it's the story of an 11-year-old and his family's journey from Afghanistan to San Francisco. And it's also about a photo contest that changes his view of the world. We're pairing that current tale about otherness with a classic about bullies and bystanders, The Hundred Dresses by Eleanor Estes. Read one or both. Think about how they're similar and different. Then send your questions to backseatbookclub@npr.org. Or to find out more about a photo assignment for you, come to npr.org/backseat. I'm Michelle Norris. Happy reading.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Go up, up, up in Minnesota, up to the boundary waters with Canada. Then, if the weather clears, hop onto a tiny research plane and fly 15 miles out across the ice of Lake Superior to the wilderness island of Isle Royale. That's where wildlife ecologist John Vucetich is now and where he's been going every winter for the last 12 years to study wolves and moose. He joins us from the researcher's bunkhouse on Isle Royale. John Vucetich, welcome to the program.
Yeah, thank you.
You're involved. This is the longest running study I've read of any predator-prey system in the world. Been going on for more than 50 consecutive years. Why are you studying wolves and moose there on Isle Royale? What's the goal?
The goal is to basically understand how it is that wolf populations affect populations of their prey. In this case, it's moose. And the reason we're interested in that is because wolves and humans sometimes conflict with one another. So this study, a lot of it is to understand how, in fact, it is that wolves affect their prey.
And how are you doing that? How do you track these populations on the island?
Well, every year we come out for about 7 weeks in the wintertime. And we'll fly every single day during this period that the weather will allow us to do so. And a couple of these wolves are radio collared, so we can find their signals that way. And much of the time, we're just flying over the island looking for tracks in the snow. And we find the tracks in the snow of these wolves, and we follow those tracks until we find the wolves. And then also when we're following those tracks, we can see where it is that they've killed the moose, and because that makes it quite a scene on the snow, blood and hair and all that kind of thing. And when we know how often they're killing the moose, then that's a big part of how we can figure out their impact.
Well, what have you been finding there in recent years in the work that you're doing?
Yeah, well, the wolf population has gone to really quite low numbers. Last year, when we counted them, there were 16 wolves. But maybe more surprisingly, of the 16 wolves, only two were females. And if those two females if they die before giving birth to more females, well, that would be the end of the population. So what we're really keen to pay attention to now is to look for signs of mating.
I almost hate to ask this, but if you're looking for signs of mating, is it pretty obvious what you're looking for, what those signs would be?
It is, yeah. The males and females are very hierarchical. There's an alpha female, and she's dominant over all the other females, and similar for the males. That dominance behavior is real characteristic when both sexes are present. And also, wolves, the physical appearance of them mating looks a lot like when dogs mate. And so we frequently see that. And it may sound peculiar, but it leaves a distinctive set of tracks in the snow. And so we can tell from that as well.
Wow, wait. You can see a distinctive set of tracks from an airplane that would tell you that wolves have been mating on the ground.
Yeah, well, what they do is when a male and female wolf mate, we say that they're tied together. And when they're connected like that, they kind of wander around the snow a little bit. Not very far, but just wander around. But, you know, you got eight legs instead of four all connected, and they don't have a normal gait.
Well, I guess if you've been doing this as long as you have, you would know what that looks like, even without the wolves there.
Yeah.
What do you think accounts for the fact that the population has declined so much?
Well, the wolf population is low right now, mainly because the moose are so low. There's a special kind of tick that bothers only the moose, and this tick has been quite abundant in recent years. And this tick is also tied to climate change. This tick does much better in warmer weathers, and we've had increasingly warm weathers in this last decade. And then finally, moose are creatures of the North Country. They do best when it's cold, and in these warm weathers are just tough for them. So climate change is certainly a big, big suspect here.
Well, John Vucetich, enjoy the rest of your time there on Isle Royale this winter. Thanks for talking to us.
You're welcome. It was great fun to share.
That's wildlife ecologist John Vucetich talking with us from Isle Royale, Michigan in Lake Superior. His blog posts are appearing on the New York Times website.
This is All Things Considered.